May it please the court, counsel, I am Jeff Enns on behalf of Liskey, Liskey & Enns, representing the appellant in this matter, and I'd ask to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
You may.
Your Honors, this is an appeal from a custody order out of Phelps County awarding joint custody to the parties involved in this case. We are asking for a reversal of the court's joint custody order based on the facts that it does not comport with statutory requirements. Also argue that the court abused its discretion, did not comport with law in finding that this was not a domestic abuse case, and then in general that the court abused its discretion in its award and essentially not awarding primary custody to the appellant. So essentially in this case, the court made a joint custody order. There was a complaint that was initially filed by the appellant as a pro se party. This complaint, while it did make a request for joint legal custody, did not make a request for joint physical custody. The appellant maintains that the trial was held without there being sufficient statutory notice that the issue of joint custody was potentially going to be litigated or ordered by the court. The record indicates that the only mention, in addition to some parenting plan agreements, some custody agreements that had been filed by pro se parties, there was a motion made by the appellee, Mr. Blank, asking for temporary physical, joint physical and legal custody. That request was ultimately denied in that the court ordered temporary custody with the appellant, which continued for a year, and no other affirmative request for legal custody or notice that this issue was going to be litigated at final hearing exists on the record.
What is your understanding of what a judge is to do to give notice to the parties, or what the parties are to give notice to each other?
Well, in terms of notice to the parties, I would expect certainly in an answer filed or a complaint or a cross complaint that relief be requested in that. As far as we're looking at notice in terms of, because the issue is the court looks at, the appellate court that is, looks at an award of joint custody, that's a big deal, and it's not generally favored. So in order to make that kind of an order, there has to be some notice so that because this is an ill-favored award, there has to be some notice so that the parties can ultimately present meaningful evidence regarding joint custody and whether or not that it is one of those rare cases where a joint custody award would be ordered. As far as what the court should have done in hindsight, if it was contemplating an award of joint custody, the appropriate action, I believe, would have been to simply at the close of evidence or some point during the trial when that became an inclination of the court to inform the parties of the same and give the parties an opportunity at a later date to present evidence regarding the issue of joint custody.
What's the record show with how joint custody got in the case?
I'm sorry?
What does the record show about how joint custody got into the case, either physical, legal, and or both?
Okay. As far as I'd mentioned the plaintiff, my client's initial complaint requesting physical custody but joint legal custody. Again, there were some stipulations that had never been ultimately ordered by the court that were filed, which I would contend should not be considered or improperly filed.
What are those stipulations say?
There was a stipulation that the parties had stipulated to a joint custody arrangement that was ultimately never offered by the court and ultimately was abandoned.
Signed by both parties?
Yes.
Filed with the court?
Yes.
And you described it just a moment ago as an improper filing. What in the world was improper about it?
Well,
they actually agreed on a custody arrangement.
That's true. There was, and I suppose without an accompanying, one of those filings without an accompanying order or request for some sort of relief from the court as far as implementing that, it creates it essentially a non-filing.
So didn't that filing make it clear that joint physical and legal custody was in the parties' minds?
What we maintain is that that is not essentially a request that, because the issue is notice to the parties that this is going to be litigated, essentially. This is going to be in front of the trial court. Those simply drifting, free-floating agreements filed do not essentially put the parties on proper notice that, yes, at trial, this is going to be an issue that's litigated, and you better be prepared to put on evidence, because this is such, joint custody orders are such a big deal when we're talking about the best interests of the children, that we cannot issue a joint custody order unless there is proper notice and some significant evidence that is presented in that regard.
So it needs to be what, big red letters or something?
I would suggest in the pretrial pleadings and in any request for affirmative relief.
Well, I'll be candid, Sam, a bit skeptical to say that a stipulation that you file with the court is meaningless. So inform us.
As far as what I am getting at is, at trial, what does that do to lend itself to the parties having notice that the court is going to be considering this particular issue of joint custody? That filing, there was essentially no affirmative request as the case progressed along, and those were filings that obviously submitted by the pro se parties, but there were no affirmative filings that, again, would put the parties on notice that at the trial in this issue, in this matter, where the issue of custody was addressed, that was going to be taken up. So
wasn't it also addressed in the joint or the temporary order as well?
I'm sorry.
Temporary order wasn't there a motion for temporary joint custody?
There was a motion. There was a motion for temporary relief, and again, I would submit that because of the nature in which joint custody is disfavored in Nebraska, it's just simply a motion for temporary relief does not meet that standard for providing some notice so that the parties can meaningfully litigate the issue of joint custody.
At trial, was joint custody discussed at all? Was there questions and testimony about joint custody?
There was an essentially an alternative, but the appellee made a request for full custody, and he was asked a question as far as alternative relief, and his testimony was, alternatively, I'd like 50-50 custody.
Before you run out of time, I want to talk to you about the domestic abuse protection, or the domestic abuse allegations. What evidence was there of domestic abuse?
The appellee's own testimony that he had open hand, I think his words were open hand smacked the appellant.
Is there evidence in the record about when that occurred?
From the inquiry that was made by the judge, I believe that it could be narrowed down to approximately 2014, so it was at the time when these parties had either one or both of their children.
Did your client testify about domestic abuse?
In that, she confirmed that incident had occurred, yes.
And what was her?
And then some holes punched in drywall.
So is there a pattern or history? Does there need to be a pattern or history?
I think the statute's clear that it's shown by one instance, and I reserve the rest of my 2 seconds.
What's the statutory argument that one instance is?
The statutory argument is just basically from the language of 43, 29, 22, pattern or history of abuse evidenced by one or more of the following acts.
Well, but before that it says domestic intimate partner abuse means an act of abuse as defined in section 42903 and a pattern or history of abuse. But does that not suggest both are required, in which case you'd need more than one incident?
I'm sorry, can I ask you to repeat your question there? I missed the first part.
Sure. 43, 29, 22, 8 says domestic intimate partner abuse means an act of abuse as defined in section 42903 and a pattern or history of abuse.
Right.
So does that require more than one incident of violence?
Well, the language and a pattern or history of abuse, and then it goes on to say evidenced by one or more of the following acts. So one act would establish a history of abuse. You don't get open hand smack your wife even once without falling under this statute.
Did you ask the court to make any specific findings regarding domestic abuse?
I did not ask the court to make any specific findings. I believe that statute does impose a duty upon the court when evidence of that is presented to make those findings.
Did you use any of the post-trial remedies that are available to request specific findings?
No, I did not. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Eisnagel, good morning to you.
Morning. Apologize, I'm a little under the weather this morning, so please bear with me. May it please the court and opposing counsel, my name is John Eisnagel, and I'm here on behalf of Bruner Frank Shoemaker. Our firm represents Mr. Caleb Blank on this action out of the District Court of Phelps County. There are two essential issues on appeal in front of the court today, and I will address the third if time allows. The first one being whether or not the district court erred in awarding joint physical custody of the party's minor children under the statutory requisites and how they applied to the present fact pattern. The second issue before you today is the issue of how domestic violence was found by the court, whether or not it should have been ruled in a different parenting plan developed with specific orders. And then the third issue is whether or not the court abused its discretion in awarding joint custody with the appellant contending that the court should have awarded her sole physical custody. Moving to the first issue, I don't believe the district court erred when it awarded joint physical custody despite the statutory language that's presented. In Hill v. Hill at 20 Nebraska Appellate 528 from the Court of Appeals in 2013, it states that a general custody hearing where joint custody is at issue but neither party has requested joint custody, the court must give the parties an opportunity to present evidence on the issues before ordering joint custody. Our contention is, one, that the appellant was on notice that joint custody was an issue at trial. Our contention, too, is that should the court to determine she was not on proper notice, she still had the opportunity to present evidence regarding the option or availability of joint custody, and then did so without any instigation from the appellee at trial. There's three things in front of the court that give away that she had notice. One is the motion for temporary hearing, where the appellee specifically requested joint custody. Mr. Enns, in his argument, contends that's not enough to put the appellant on notice at trial when there's a final determination to be made. That may be true. However, and as was addressed as Mr. Enns presented his argument, was the issue that there was a parenting plan that was signed and notarized by both parties, submitted to the court, and had this case have gone the way I'm sure my client had intended and hoped for, that would have been the end of the discussion. That is where he had hoped this case would end. The issue was reopened, and trial then was held on that matter. Thirdly, I don't believe it's proper to say the appellant did not have notice that joint custody was an issue. There were no opening arguments made at the time of trial. The appellant was the plaintiff and therefore presented first. And one of the initial questions after getting through some of the more minutia was, do you believe that joint custody is an issue? Asked by her attorney to her without the appellee, the defendant, providing any evidence or any argument. They brought up the issue at trial. They argued the issue. They presented evidence, and they lost. Now that they don't have their satisfactory end, they've appealed, and all of a sudden she no longer has noticed that that was an issue at trial. For those three issues, the motion for temporary hearing, the stipulation, and the fact that the testimony at trial immediately started the argument on whether or not joint custody was an option, I believe that the defendant did have proper notice, and if not, still had the opportunity to have an evidentiary hearing where she presented argument and evidence of why it would not work and then lost at trial. It should also be noticed that the purpose of pleadings is to give, in part, to give a reasonable notice of what is to come. And I can't look you in the eye today and tell you this matter couldn't have been resolved if a proper answer had been filed, or this matter couldn't have been resolved if a counterclaim had been filed. The answer would already be there for you. But at the same time, just because those two options aren't available doesn't mean that the appellant didn't have proper notice. It's in the pleadings, it's in the court records, and it's in the testimony at the time of trial. Moving on to the issue of domestic abuse, Nebraska Revised Statute 43-2932 states that a parenting plan must be developed, that's a requirement, if domestic abuse is proven by preponderance of the evidence. We have the issue of the slap, where my client admitted at the time of trial that he had slapped his wife in an instance that was several years, or at least a few years, before we actually had filed for dissolution and had arrived at trial. There were other accusations thrown around. At no time did the appellant testify that there was any bodily injury that would lead one to believe that this was an actual domestic assault.
Is there anything in the record about a police report being made?
I don't believe there is a police report that was filed, but I'm not sure of that.
Was it an attempt at domestic injury?
That's arguable, but again, no evidence was presented, and the standard of preponderance of the evidence, which the judge made a finding
what
on.
What more do you need? He admitted an open hand slap.
Well, I believe that you can have an instance where two bodies touch or hit each other where there's not an intent basis or there was no injury, in which case in a criminal trial where obviously the burden is much higher, you wouldn't find that to be an assault without more specific evidence. However, I believe a better argument would also be the argument that was previously addressed, where the statutes also say there needs to be a pattern of this kind of behavior. One instance is not enough to suggest that this is a domestic violence case. And I believe that's why Judge Harder, in her order, made that determination where she states this is not a domestic violence case as defined by the Nebraska statutes, which is contained within her order.
What's our standard of review with respect to that factual finding?
Well, if it's an issue of law, the standard is obviously independent review. But with some of the issues, as in far as the evidence and preponderance of the evidence, we give great discretion to the court's weighing of the witness's testimony, in which case it would be abuse of discretion. Finally, I'll move on to my third point if there's no further questions on that issue. The court did not abuse its discretion by finding that the party should share joint custody. There was ample evidence presented by both sides that they are able to work together. That's contained within the transcript. I believe the appellant testified that she had made accommodations for the appellee's sake when it came to their temporary order in regard to visitation. There was plenty of evidence from witnesses and from the appellee that stated he is able to provide the care required and the responsibilities required to continue to have or to make joint custody an option. He also testified his willingness to work with the appellant throughout this. And so I think the court, having all the evidence in front of it, made the correct determination that joint custody was available to the parties. Because one, there's evidence they could work together, and two, the evidence was overwhelming in the fact that the appellee presented a good case that he was able to reach those responsibilities. While I have time, I believe it was also addressed in the appellant's argument, or at least in his brief, that it was improper for the court to award one party final say in the matters of joint custody. I believe he said that that shouldn't have been done, and I just wanted to touch on that briefly. There's case law where that has been determined to be a proper action, giving one party final say. This case is a little different, and from my practice and what I've seen, in that one party was given two areas of health and religion, and the other party was given education. I believe Judge Harder did that, and I probably shouldn't be speaking for her, but I believe she did that because the evidence on those areas were tilted toward one side or the other. For instance, my client made it very specific that he cared deeply for the children's religious upbringing, where Mr. Enza's client testified regarding the education and the importance, excuse me, that that holds for her. That's been upheld in other case law that's contained within my brief. With that, I am running out of time, so if there's no
further. I did have one question on the intimate partner violence. Was the only issue with respect to that whether or not your client initiated such conduct, or was it also under consideration about whether or not the appellant initiated such?
We were not seeking any finding regarding domestic abuse, but there was evidence presented at trial of violence between the two. I think specifically punching a wall, where I don't believe that that's violence between the two, and I don't believe it's a threat of violence. But there was more issues presented. I believe there was even an issue of child abuse accusation thrown out that I believe Judge Harder didn't find to have be very convincing. Thank you, and with that, I would relinquish the rest of my time.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. The next case of the day, then, is Holloman versus Taylor.